This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Nobody likes thinking about a financial crisis. We get that. But for some people, it is kinda their job. Lessons learned 10 years on from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Wednesday today, the 5th day of September. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We are, as of today, 10 days short of a straight-up decade since the collapse of Lehman Brothers and the beginning of the scariest parts of the financial crisis. We did the look back yesterday with Neil Kashkari. He ran the TARP, the bank bailout, for Hank Paulson at the Treasury Department during the crisis. Today, we're going to do the look forward from where Kashkari sits now as the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis.
On the theory that there's another crisis coming, hopefully not as bad as the one 10 years ago, but there's another financial recession and crisis coming. What's going to cause it? What's your guess?
It could be any number of things. It could be a spark in emerging markets like we're seeing in Turkey, where there's a lot of uncertainty. That could potentially trigger a crisis of confidence and could spill over globally into the U.S. It could be the Federal Reserve. It could be that we overdo raising interest rates. I've also been saying that we're raising interest rates too aggressively. We might keep raising interest rates and the economy can't take it and we put the country into recession.
Well, you've been very public about your dissents when you're a voting member of the Federal Open Market Committee. And I don't know if Chairman Powell is actually going to listen to this interview, but his people certainly will. Why do you think the Fed keeps going?
Well, we're trying to assess, is the economy running at full potential? We want to keep it from overheating, because if it overheats, then that can lead to runaway inflation, which is really bad for everybody.
Right.
But assessing, is the economy running at potential, below potential, or above potential, it's an inexact science. So I've simply been saying, I don't see any indication that we're running above potential. So let's let it keep running. And if we start to see signs that it's overheating, we can always raise rates then. So I think my colleagues and I are having an honest disagreement about this very fundamental question.
Even though unemployment's at 4-ish% and there is no inflation in this economy today, you're still leery.
I'm leery that we've been saying for years now, we're at full employment. That's it. There's no more workers. And then all these workers come off the sidelines saying, yeah, I want jobs. And this is in a modest wage growth environment. Imagine if wage growth actually picks up. Maybe a lot more workers will come in off the sidelines. The more workers that come in off the sidelines and take jobs, the better for the U.S. economy, the better for those workers, the better for all of us. So let's let that continue.
One of the things I talked about actually with Chairman Powell when I sat down with him 6 weeks or maybe 2 months ago was how hard he's working to demystify the Fed, to speak English, and you know he's changing his press conferences and all of that stuff. How much does it matter that Americans have some economic literacy just in terms of being aware of the crisis or next crisis or what's happening or just knowing what's going on?
I think it's really important. I think, first of all, his work to demystify the Fed, I think, is very positive. We need to earn people's trust so that if there is a future crisis and we have to do unconventional or confusing actions, that they give us the benefit of the doubt and that we've earned their trust. So I really support what he's doing there. And I do think so. I mean, to minimize the chances of future crises, our citizens need to understand what's happened in the past so that they can see the signs of, hey, this could happen again. Let's be more careful going into it. And so I think the more literate, financially literate our citizens are, the better.
What happens if people don't understand? What happens if they just let the black box be the black box?
Well, that's what unfortunately was happening in leading into the last crisis. Remember, Alan Greenspan, when he was chairman, he intentionally spoke in a very mystifying way because it made himself seem smart, and it just made everybody else scared to ask about the Fed. Well, that didn't build trust. And so in 08, when the crisis happened and we needed people to trust us, there was a big trust deficit. And that trust deficit then got deeper through the controversial actions that the Fed had to take. So the things that Chairman Powell and Janet Yellen before him are trying to do are to rebuild that trust.
To this idea of the crisis next time, and maybe it's going to be Treasury Secretary Mnuchin, maybe it's going to be his successor. Somebody's going to have to go to the Hill and say, we need this authority to wind down this bank, or we need this amount of money. If Congress doesn't get it and doesn't understand, we'll have another vote like the TARP going down. Is Congress not being willing to engage on this going to make the next crisis worse?
If it gets so bad that we absolutely need Congress's help, yes. If they refuse just because the politics of the moment do not allow them. You know, many members of Congress paid for their TARP vote with their seats. It was one of the finest moments in our democracy's political history, seeing leaders across the aisle step forward and do what's in the country's best interest, not in their own professional best interest. And then they lost their seats. And so if this were to happen again and people said, no, I want to keep my job, then the country's going to suffer for it. And that is scary. And that's why everything we can do to rebuild the trust across party lines, we need to do.
So when the next crisis happens, are we ready?
I don't know. I think the challenge is, if there were another 08-type crisis today, could we get Congress to support us the way we did in 08? I think probably not. And that means the U.S. economy, the American people, Main Street, would bear the ultimate consequences of that.
That must be terrifying. I mean, you're a guy who's kind of in charge of that.
It is terrifying. Now, the good news is we're always out there looking for signs of another big crisis brewing. We don't see signs of that. But then again, our track record is terrible in seeing signs before they actually happen. So don't take a lot of comfort from the fact that we're not seeing it right now.
Okay.
So two things real quick. Laughing there, I think, so I don't cry. But also this little bit of color. In the lobby of the Minneapolis Fed, the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis, there were actual teller windows, which struck me as funny. But look, let's go back to the beginning of that bit of the interview when I asked where the next crisis is going to come from. First words out of Neil Kashkari's mouth, emerging markets, which gets us neatly in an unfortunate kind of way to one slice of the economic news of this Wednesday. More troubles in emerging markets, specifically in their currencies, which continue to fall against the dollar. The Argentinian peso has lost half its value against the greenback this year. Same for the Turkish lira. Investors are souring on Brazil and India, South Africa, also Indonesia. But here's the thing. Some of those countries have been through currency and financial crises before. And while, yes, each crisis is different, we do know that sometimes countries hit by currency flu can take years or perhaps even as much as a decade to come back. From Washington Marketplace's Scott Tong has that one.
To most of us, emerging market currency crises can seem far away. But for people living in the affected countries, the pain can be real, says economist Liliana Rojas Suarez of the Center for Global Development.
After plagues, natural disasters, and wars, financial crisis hurts a country the most.
In the 80s, she remembers Latin America suffered a lost decade. Investors and bankers fled, countries heavily in debt ran out of money, and governments slashed their safety nets with consequences for the poor.
The gains in terms of income inequality as well as reduction of poverty have gone backwards.
Some economies take a long time to recover. If there's no lender of last resort like the International Monetary Fund to bail them out, or if there's political upheaval to make things worse. This time around, there's fear Venezuela could see long-term pain, says Meg Lunsager. She's a former IMF official, now at the Wilson Center.
Even if there was a major economic reform, change in the political leadership there, it would take many, many years to bring the oil sector back up to par. You'd need to get Venezuelans to come back home.
It's a matter of confidence. To fix your emerging market debt, your economy, and your politics, to lure workers and international investors back. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
One more bit from Neil Kashkari coming up a little bit later in the program, by the way. Wall Street Today tech got clobbered. Otherwise, kind of a wash. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. I said emerging markets were one slice of the economic news today. The trade deficit was the other. From the Commerce Department this morning came news that the trade gap, remember that's the difference between what we sell overseas and what we buy and import back here, hit a five-month high in July. That is the exact opposite of what President Trump wants. Trade deficits are his favorite economic bugaboo, even though they are not necessarily bad in and of themselves. And as Marketplace's Sabri Benishore explains, the president and the Congress are not doing themselves any favors in that regard.
The government is borrowing more money to pay for its tax cuts. That is making the trade deficit worse.
This is one of the great ironies of fiscal and monetary policy in general.
Robert Martin is an economist at UBS. Here's how that works. If the tax cuts are stimulating the economy, people are going to buy more stuff. And some of that stuff, televisions and cars and iPhones, is going to come from other countries. Not only that, but hungry American consumers will buy up goods that American companies would have otherwise exported.
Rising imports, falling exports, that's the definition of a larger trade deficit.
There's another way the tax cuts are making the trade deficit worse. All that money the government's borrowing, it's got to come from somewhere. Emily Blanchard teaches economics at Dartmouth's Tuck School of Business.
If the government wants to borrow more, either it's going to come from within the U.S. or outside the U.S.
If it all came from inside the U.S., that would hurt economic growth. What's the point of a tax cut pumping money into the economy if government borrowing sucks it right back out? So some of that money has to come from foreigners.
And where do they get those dollars from?
Mary Lovely is professor of economics at Syracuse University.
They get those dollars from Americans who want to buy their goods and services.
If the government needs dollars from foreigners, then foreigners need dollars from American consumers. And foreigners get those dollars when American consumers buy foreign goods, also known as imports. The trade deficit gets worse as the government borrows to pay for its tax cuts.
This administration has two policies that are fighting each other.
Lovely says just about every American economist predicted this, and now it's happening. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
It'll be a year later this month that Hurricane Maria hit Puerto Rico. Thousands died, thousands more were injured or lost their homes or had to live for a long, long time without electricity. It was a year ago last month that Hurricane Harvey hit Houston and southeast Texas. Those two storms come together in a report from the Government Accountability Office this week, which says FEMA wasn't ready for what happened in Puerto Rico. More than half of the agency's workers that were sent to the island didn't have the training they needed to do their jobs because the more experienced people were busy dealing with other disasters like Harvey. From WESA in Pittsburgh, Marketplace's Erica Barris has that one.
When it comes to planning, FEMA tends to let history be its guide. Solomon Shong, public policy professor at UC Berkeley, has studied the economics of hurricanes. And he says FEMA is set up to handle big events based on what's previously occurred.
But as the climate's shifting and as we experience more frequent and more extreme disasters, we're going to be kind of continuously off balance.
Last year saw record numbers of wildfires and hurricanes. Jeff Slegelmelch, who runs the National Center for Disaster Preparedness at Columbia University, says FEMA's current approach also doesn't require enough from states and local governments because
there's more of an incentive to just get reimbursed through a federally declared disaster.
But shifting the financial burden can be tricky, with places like Puerto Rico, which already was deep in debt. The GAO report found FEMA assumed many responsibilities of the local government because of the lack of power and communication. And money alone won't fix the problem, says Gary Webb. He's professor of emergency management at the University of North Texas. He says more work needs to be done up front to prepare for catastrophes.
Unfortunately, though, we have a system that's mostly reactive. And it's also very costly. And that is, we don't make investments in mitigation or disaster prevention until after an event has occurred.
The report also noted that the FEMA efforts in Puerto Rico were the largest and longest response in the agency's 38-year history. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
Coming up.
She didn't know how much the Coke cost, so she didn't include that in her money diary.
Not Coca-Cola, I might add. But first, let's do the numbers. On Wall Street today, the big story was congressional scrutiny of the tech sector. Investors drove the tech-heavy NASDAQ down 0.1%, 96 points, closed at 79.95. The Dow Industrials barely budged, fraction of 1%, 22 points to the good, 25,974. S&P 500 down about 0.25%, 8 points, 28.88. As I said, big part of that NASDAQ drop, testimony from Twitter and Facebook executives on Capitol Hill. Shares of Twitter down just over 6%. Facebook logged off 2.3%. Elsewhere in tech, Amazon down about 2.1%. Apple shriveled 0.6%. Shares of Nike rebounded a bit after yesterday's sell-off, closed up about 0.4%. Today, American Express charged down about 1.25%. This after the Wall Street Journal reported the FBI is investigating the company's foreign exchange pricing. Always risky, foreign exchange, you know. Bonds closed flat. Yield on the 10-year T-note stayed at 2.89%. You're listening to Marketplace.
I'm Shepard from Lincoln, Nebraska, and I listen to Marketplace several times, actually, every day, because it's got the economic news and developments that are important to me. I donate to Marketplace so that it can be available to everyone, and I hope you'll join me in this effort. Thanks.
To join Shepard as a Marketplace investor, donate online at marketplace.org.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. Here is a not-at-all-hypothetical question. Would you willingly write down and then have published a record of everything you spend money on in a week? Refinery29, which is a media company focused mostly on younger women, asked exactly that of its readers, no names attached, of course, for a series they call Money Diaries. Lindsay Stanberry is the Work and Money editor at Refinery29, and her book, also called Money Diaries, is a compilation of some of those published stories. Lindsay, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Why did you start doing this project? It's been going on a couple of years now, right?
Yeah, we launched it in January of 2016. We had started covering more work and money content, and we had seen that women were really interested in these personal financial stories. And an editor that I work with, Jessica Chow, came to me and said, you know, we should do Money Diaries. And I said, I don't know. It might be boring. Who wants to see receipts?
Funny.
Is it going to be interesting storytelling? But I told her to go do it. We really like to experiment at Refinery. So she came back to me a week later with a diarist who was in her 20s and living in Brooklyn and a designer. And during the week, she complained about her job, got avocado toast, took an Uber, and was like really typical millennial. And then she went on a Tinder date and did Coke. And had a really funny line about how she didn't know how much the Coke cost.
Wow.
So she didn't include that in her money diary.
And who says this was going to be boring?
And who said this is going to be boring?
Man.
And I was like, oh, we're onto something. This is amazing. So we published that one and it did well. And then we published another one. And the momentum just built from there. We did one a week and then two a week and then three a week. And then this year we started publishing every day.
And now a book. They are anything but boring. I'll tell you what. Why women, first of all?
I think that women are just now beginning to tell their financial stories. It's always been dominated by men. When I started the work and money section at Refinery29, I did it because I felt like so much of the narrative around money was either super pink for women, you know, with the advice of like, don't buy lattes or don't buy shoes, or it was like very male-dominated stock market sports terms. And that was so alienating. So I wanted a place where women could really tell their own stories. And we found that they were really excited to do that.
What do you know about how these diaries are consumed, right? I mean, how often do they get read? Do certain ones get read more than others? Do we know that?
We do find that, you know, the high earners are more popular, women who make over six figures. And I think that that kind of plays into our interest in general in society with how women and men spend their wealth. It's fascinating.
Yeah, there's all kinds of interesting things in here about, you know, women who pay for like dinner on a date and stuff like that.
Yeah. And the book, you know, I really wanted to cover who pays on the first date and what does that say about your relationship and when do you reveal to your partner if you have debt. I know many couples who are, you know, uncomfortable getting into relationships because they have six figures in student loan debt. It's a reality for us. And I think it's really important to talk about.
There's no other than salary information, right? There's no demographics in here. We don't necessarily know race and other sort of things that go to inequality and money in this society, do we?
No, we don't. But it's really interesting because there's often signifiers. If you're a careful reader, you can tell when a diarist reveals her race or her background. And, you know, for as much as we originally thought this was just going to be a tally of people's daily spending, it's so much more than that. You know, they reveal what they like to do for exercise, how they spend their weekends, their relationships, their problems at work. And we work actively to make sure that the diaries that we're publishing feel diverse.
Yeah. So some of the producers here, as we were getting ready to do this interview, they did their own money diaries, and I'm probably telling tales out of school here, but I won't mention any names. But first of all, we're not going to publish them because we didn't do them for that, but just to see, you know, how people were spending. And it's interesting because people like didn't make certain purchases because they knew they were going to diary about this.
Yeah, it's fascinating, right? I actually think that Money Diaries, the series, is really entertaining, but doing a Money Diaries of financial exercise is really powerful. I often say that I go to the store and I swipe my credit card without looking at the total, and I think a lot of people do that. Mm-hmm. I know writing this book, I really curbed my latte habit, even though I tell people I will never say don't buy a latte. There was something about knowing I was spending $5 on that kind of made me stop and pause and, you know, go and get the coffee at the office, which isn't terrible. I'm lucky.
Lindsay Stanbury, she's the work and money editor at Refinery 29. The new book is called Money Diaries. It is, honestly, it's completely fascinating. Lindsay, thanks a lot.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Just because there is a little voyeur in all of us, we've got one of those more than six-figure diaries that everybody loves to read. We got it online, marketplace.org. We're going to go back to that Neil Kashkari interview one last time because there is another bit of it that ought to be heard about the crisis and what it did to the Fed.
Do you think the Fed actually, and this is the last Fed question I'll ask because you and I could do this all day, but do you think they're still institutionally, as it were, because the people have changed, a little bit scarred by the crisis?
They're scarring from the financial crisis, yes, but they're scarring, bigger scarring, from the inflation of the 1970s.
Huh.
And I think that that is persuading us more than anything else and why we're so biased towards, you know, we say that we have a symmetric view of inflation. We don't mind if it's 2.1 or 1.9, right. But in our practice, in what we actually do, we are much more worried about high inflation than we are low inflation. And I think that that is a scar from the 1970s.
It's interesting. It's monetary policy by fear, basically.
You know, policymakers are human and each has their own set of emotions and their own histories, and we do our best with the data that we have and the experiences that we've had.
For those not old enough to remember that inflation crisis of the late 1970s, it was bad. By 1980, inflation hit 14% in this economy. Today, just by comparison, it's 2%, which I mentioned as a way to get to this. You know who worries about inflation and interest rates besides the Fed? Presidents. That's who. I talked to Jimmy Carter about 8 years or so ago. He had a book out, and we touched on a couple of times during that interview about the person he had picked in the late 1970s to chair the Federal Reserve, a guy by the name of Paul Volcker. On the topic of Paul Volcker, if I could just back up for a second.
Yeah, please.
You put him in the job. Yes. You, in essence, made this deal with him where he would do what he had to do and you would suffer the political consequences, according to your telling of it. And yet, it seems to me that he is most remembered and the president he is most associated with is Ronald Reagan for breaking the back of inflation. Does that gall you at all?
Not gall me, but I recognize
bug the you
fact.
A little bit?
Well, you know, I was the one that suffered politically, and Ronald Reagan was the one that benefited from the Paul Volcker economic philosophy. But I don't begrudge the fact that it happened during the next term. I thought the next term was going to be mine.
30 years later, he still remembers, right? If you're a youngin' and not old enough to remember inflation at 14%, allow me to introduce you to Marketplace.org. We've got five things you need to know about inflation and the 1970s in this economy. Also there, by the way, the full transcript of me and Neil Kashkari.
Mm-hmm.
This final note on the way out today. The setting is the House Energy and Commerce Committee. The scene is Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey testifying about how and why his company decides what shows up in people's feeds. Enter from the rear of the room, protester from the risers, Congressman Billy Long, Republican of Missouri.
Jack Dorsey is trying to influence the election, huh? To sway the election.
What's she saying? I can't understand her. What?
Steal the election. That is why he is censoring and shadow banning.
That actually happened in the Congress of the United States today. From the congressman's website, quote, for over 30 years, Congressman Long was a real estate broker and owner of Billy Long Auctions, LLC in Springfield. Mo. On a more serious note, Molly Wood and I had a great conversation about filter bubbles and biases and all the stuff that Jack Dorsey was talking about today. We did it on our podcast that we do together. It's called Make Me Smart. Check it out. All right, we got to go. The NASDAQ, as we said, down 1.1%, 96 points. Part of that on Jack Dorsey's testimony. The Dow Industrials barely budge, really. Up 22 points. S&P 500 down about 0.25%, 8 points there. Sarah Bergere, Jake Gorski, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Dan Powell, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.